Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why did the bottom fall out of the U.S. economy between 2007 and 2009? And is it naive to assume we can return to the rates of growth we came to expect in the latter half of the 20th century? The unemployment rate has gradually ticked down, and the stock market has shot way up since the worst of the Great Recession. Yet the gross domestic product is still not expanding in the way we once simply expected it to. And my guest today says the reasons for that are realities that have been building not since the mortgage crisis, but for decades. James K. Galbraith holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. James, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
So the financial meltdown was horrible, but things have improved since then. What tells you that it was, in fact, a permanent turning point rather than a temporary aberration?
Well, nobody knows what permanent actually means.
Yeah.
But when the crisis occurred, there was a very widespread expectation, which was built into official forecasts, that there would be a rapid and complete rebound. And that conditioned the debate over what to do and limited the options that were on the table at that time. So we went through 5 or 6 years of repeated disappointment with slower growth. And while unemployment came down very largely because people were leaving the labor force or not returning to it, the employment rates have remained really very low by comparison with what they were 15 years ago. So the overall performance of the economy is on quite a different track than it had been before. And the book is an investigation into the turning points that have brought us to that result. Basically, it's an argument that the crisis itself was the outgrowth of developments over the previous decades and not a shock to a system that was in good shape in 2006.
But we sure did lull ourselves into a sense of security that the kind of growth we became accustomed to was something we almost deserved.
Yes, and over 50 years, if you just look at the record of the growth rate, it's easy to see why Americans in particular became conditioned to this idea. There was some interruption of the prosperity in the 1970s, and then the 1980s and 90s came along, and whether you thought it was Reagan or whether you thought it was Clinton, there was this period of resumed growth. And part of the reality of the case is that the American experience here was quite exceptional in the world. Many parts of the world experienced a real turning point in the 1970s and never returned after that to the growth rates that they had enjoyed for only about a quarter of a century after the end of the Second World War. Whereas for the United States, we really did, and we did so in part at the expense of the rest of the world. And so in some sense, we came to 2000 with a sense of the continuity of history, which was not only unique, but also, I think, quite unrealistic.
It's no small thing that energy after the Second World War was cheap and abundant, and there weren't as many global competitors for it.
Yes, and the energy picture was something that economists after the Second World War were very reluctant to take up, and they tended to treat it as an almost insignificant factor. But the reality was, of course, that oil was the American fuel. It was a fuel which had provenance very largely in this region, in Texas and in surrounding areas. And it provided a basis for economic development in the United States that put us on a very favorable footing for the first 30 years after the Second World War. In the 1970s, we had a major adjustment because the domestic lower 48 state production peaked, and we ended up importing much, much more and being much more dependent on the Middle East. But then in the 1980s, oil prices for us fell again, and they stayed low into 2000. So that, again, gave us a great benefit. That benefit went away to a very large extent in the decade or so, near decade between 2000 and 2008. And you remember that just before the Great Crisis, oil prices peaked at $148 a barrel, which had was a major pressure on people's purchasing power and living standards. One of the interesting things that wasn't anticipated in 2007 and has happened since, and is obvious to anybody in your listening area, is the natural gas boom, which has again changed the situation in America's favor. And that's something which we'll see how long it lasts, but it's certainly a major factor differentiating the performance of the U.S. now from that in Europe.
Well, what about natural gas? I mean, you say we'll see how it will play out. There are people who today are saying, okay, crisis averted, even if we have to convert the kinds of engines that we use, the United States is pretty energy secure for the foreseeable future.
Troublesome phrase in what you just said is the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
The problem there is that we simply don't have, so far as I'm aware, reliable information that can tell us how far into the future we can foresee this boom continuing. It may. The optimist may be right, but there are certainly pessimists out there also whose voices can be heard. And I don't think there's anybody who actually knows where the truth lies. I suspect it would be prudent to lean a little bit on the pessimistic side and prepare for the day when the pressure starts running out in some of these wells, or when the cost of continuing to drill them goes to high levels. It's at the moment we're not there, and we have averted an immediate crisis in energy costs, but that doesn't tell us that the good fortune will continue indefinitely.
So easy growth had already begun to erode by the 1970s, and you mentioned the fact that there were great pressures on fuel prices. What else began to change at that time, and why didn't we see this coming?
Well, some people, of course, did see it coming. The problem is that their voices were substantially, I won't say suppressed, but they didn't prevail in the public discussion. So another tendency, a tendency of economists to treat the 1980s and 90s as something they called the Great Moderation, and to pat themselves on the back for having discovered formulas for successful economic policy. When in fact what was going on was that in the 1980s and 1990s, we relied increasingly on credit booms to fuel economic activity. And these came in waves. In the 1980s, it was the savings and loan institutions that created a very temporary boom in certain kinds of lending activity, very corrupt, and it collapsed, of course, and Texas was at the epicenter of that. In the 1990s, it was a business boom, an information technology boom, which built up very rapidly in the late 1990s and generated widespread prosperity, but came to an end in 2000 with the crash of the NASDAQ. And then in the 2000s, it was real estate again, much more broadly based, or the mortgage finance debacle fueled by this massive conversion of ordinary home mortgages into fancy debt securities that could be marketed around the world. And that was, again, a very corrupt enterprise that crashed spectacularly in 2007. So while we were telling ourselves a story about having discovered an elixir for a continued growth, we were in fact relying on increasingly unstable and unreliable expedients to give the appearance of that growth. And that's what really crashed in 2007.
Reading this book and the descriptions of growth that we've seen since the 80s and beyond, there's that expression that a rising tide lifts all boats. But it seems that since that time, the rising tides in this country have lifted the yachts and left all the other boats to sink.
That's a highly debatable proposition. And I've just been reading a very interesting new paper by a professor at Georgetown, I believe, by the name of Stephen Rose, who argues, I think, and quite persuasively, that we could overstate the extent to which the gains, and there have been gains over this period, flowed exclusively to the top. In fact, as the middle class has enjoyed substantial improvements in its living standards compared to what they were 30 or 40 years ago. That said, there's no question that inequality has increased. There's been a major concentration of power at the very top of the income distribution. And in particular, we now have a politics which is vastly more oriented toward very big money than it was 50 or 60 years ago, in which the social organizations, the trade unions, consumer organizations, and other kinds of civic groups play a much smaller role. And basically, in both parties, you are looking to the for the support of a very well-heeled factions in order to establish a political position. And that any United States senator will tell you that that is the bane of their existence. Any presidential candidate will tell you that that's how you put together a credible campaign. Someone was telling me a day or so ago that a presidential campaign requires, just to get going, $30 or $40 million every 3 months, every quarter. These are sums which basically require you to cater to one element or another of the super rich.
James, how much is income inequality tied to wages, and how much of it, at least in the modern economy, is a result of non-wage income from things like investments and capital gains?
In the U.S., a large share of the rise in income inequality is associated with capital asset prices, with the stock market, with real estate. Some of that is classified as wage income. That's to say, you get a salary from a technology company that's based upon their raising capital from venture capital. That may be counted technically in your tax form as wages. But it's fundamentally driven by the run-up in stock prices and capital asset prices. And that is a very big piece of what has happened in the United States. Just to give you a little experiment in sort of statistical checking on this, we ran the calculation. What if you took five counties that made the biggest contribution to the rise in inequality in the 1990s and took them out of the data effectively? And those five were Manhattan, three counties in Northern California, San Francisco, San Mateo, and Santa Clara, King County, Washington, which is Seattle. You take those out of the data, the rise in total income inequality fell by about half.
Wow.
So you're looking at banking and you're looking at information technology at that particular moment. In the middle 2000s, you get a big growth around the national capital in defense and in contracting, intelligence, outsourcing, and that kind of thing. And in 2007, 2008, it's in the hot spots of real estate speculation. So you have income surges that drive the inequality measures, and they are very, very concentrated and very closely related to the pricing of assets rather than to wages and ordinary working and activity.
Generally speaking, do rich countries tend to have less income inequality than poor ones?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. The basic, I do a lot of international comparison. This is not really the subject of this particular book, but a major research effort over 20 years. And the simple common sense fact is that if the way you become a rich country is to have a large middle class, a poor country almost always has a few very rich people, people who own the mines or control the revenue from them, people who own the latifundia, the big plantations, and a lot of very poor people. But you cannot have a rich country that way. It's just not possible. A rich country is one which has a middle class, and as a middle class, by definition, reduces the inequality in the society as a whole. So you see a very clear profile. As countries get richer, generally speaking, over the 20th century anyway, they became very substantially more egalitarian than they were before.
My guest is James K. Galbraith. He is Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with James K. Galbraith, who is chair in government business relations at the LBJ School at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is called The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Can you talk, James, about how the costs of resources have increased over the past several decades and what the effect is of that on the economic fortunes of American businesses and industries and also individual Americans?
Well, we are both a resource-producing and a resource-using country, but the balance has moved in strongly in favor of the resource users, and we therefore import a great deal. And that's a drain on the national balance sheet. It's a drain on national purchasing power. So when the cost of extracting resources goes up, or when the cost of importing them goes up, that's a pressure that every business is going to feel. It's going to be part of their bottom line. And that means that the effect of rising resource prices on us is constraining. It's like a tax increase. That was part of the picture in the run-up to the crisis in 2008, and a part that was not really talked about very much. The oil prices were going up. One of the reasons they were was that this market had become heavily financialized. So it became possible, since oil is storable, to slow down the tankers, to fill up the storage tanks, to hold the stuff in the ground with a view that you were going to dump it on the open market at a moment closer to the peak and get more money for any given amount of oil. And that, I think, also contributed to this very big speculative run-up in the price. And then, of course, it all comes to a crashing decline as the economy as a whole goes into the tank. What we're seeing now, of course, in the last few weeks, is a marked decline in the price of oil. The price is now, I think, in the low 80s and perhaps heading lower still. And that, of course, works the other way. It will support purchasing power, support economic activity in an importing country, but it will also introduce or call attention to the element of uncertainty. And since we also produce, what you're going to hear about is that the lower price of oil is going to cause problems for high-cost producers, for people who are using particularly expensive techniques to get new oil or gas out of deep fields, and also for those who were in the business of producing alternative resources, which is another economic activity, wind and solar power, who can compete at $100 a barrel but may have trouble at 80 or 70. There are problems with a high cost of resources, and there are problems with a volatile cost of resources. We are going to experience that second class of problems in the period immediately ahead.
Can we have prosperity, a broad middle class prosperity, without growth?
My answer to that is that it's difficult, but it's possible. You can't, I think, operate very effectively in an economy with a large private sector if you have no growth at all, because at that point, private businesses lose expectation for being able to make money, and then the incentive for staying in business goes away. So that's deeply problematic. But can you do well if you are constrained to a lower growth path? I think the answer to that is, if you work out carefully how to do that, you can, in fact, do all right. And the important point about achieving that is to maintain and strengthen systems of social insurance so that the whole community is protected against the worst outcomes. If you have a high rate of growth, you don't need to worry too much about social insurance because everybody's going to get some benefit of growth, or most people will. But if you're working with a narrower margin, then you need to be more, not less, careful about having effective protections for the population as a whole.
We have an email here from Bob in Dallas who asks that you address the assertion that economic growth is fueled primarily by debt and inflation, and this economic model has become unsustainable since the beginning of the Cold War.
Since the beginning of the Cold War.
That's what Bob says.
Go back to 1946. I think that the growth of in the first Cold War period was balanced between public expenditure and private, the growth of private debt, company debt, and personal debt. The problem of the most recent period has become very unbalanced and was very heavily dependent on private debts taken up by households who couldn't pay them and offered by lenders who knew that the clients would not be able to pay, and whose only interest in making the loan was in booking a fee when it was originated and then booking another fee when it was sold off to a gullible German, let's say. And that model was basically programmed to explode after a very short period of time, which it did. Are we in a more sustainable phase now? It's an open question. We had a substantial recovery, for example, in the automobile sector. It's also very strongly debt-fueled. And I do know economists. I was speaking to one yesterday in Washington, D.C., a fellow by the name of Bill Spriggs, used to be the chairman of the economics department at Howard University there, who made the argument that that these debts are also substantially subprime and not secure, that they're fragile. So I think the thing we should worry about is not the whole Cold War period, but that in recent years we've become very reliant on private debts of a particularly fragile, unsustainable, and frankly, in many cases, fraudulent type. And to the extent that we continue to rely on that, we're going to have periodic disasters.
Let's talk about a source of public debts. Mm-hmm. Are we actually getting the benefits we pay for with regard to our spending for military technology and national defense?
For national defense?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very open question at this point. I am the chair of the board of a group of economists that concerns itself very directly with that question. It's called Economists for Peace and Security. And the specialists in our group who really work on these questions have important issues with, in particular, aircraft procurement in recent years, and in particular programs. The F-22 had its own problems. The F-35 has much deeper problems. And the question is, why are we really doing this to procure weapon systems for which we do not have any very clear-cut mission and where we have exhausted the capacity of the technology to improve at reasonable cost. So I think the answer to that question in large parts of the military domain is that no, and that we should be re-examining the need for certain weapon systems much more comprehensively than we have been.
Is it reasonable to look at the defense industry as a kind of government-funded job creator?
I think the answer to that is also no. The defense industry has been important, continues to be important in sustaining science and engineering, technology community, material science, and hydrodynamics and aerodynamics, things of that nature. But in terms of the numbers of jobs, it's not a particularly large piece of the American picture. These are highly specialized jobs. Most Americans work, frankly, in the services sector, and they work in healthcare, and they work in education, and they work in civilian activities. So, if we want to look for the future of employment, it's certainly not going to be in publicly supported military procurement.
What about geopolitical volatility, conflict in other parts of the world that may not directly appear to directly affect the United States? How does that affect the prospects for economic growth here at home?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think that, of course, we benefit from being on our own relatively secure continent. But when you move out to the wider world, there are important risks that were not there in the Cold War period and that appeared to be under control in the first 15 years or so after the end of the Cold War, when there was this idea that U.S. military power was going to be able to stabilize the world as a whole. The mistake that we made in the 2000s was to put that idea to the test. We went into Afghanistan, went into Iraq, and what we learned and what any, I think, professional military involved in that experience will tell you is that the effectiveness of military power is really quite limited. It's not just our military power. It's any form of military power. And so the world is emerging as a more unstable place. It's emerging as a place where large regional powers are able to pursue their own interests without having strong necessity to respond to what we want. And that's true of Russia, it's true of China, it's true of Iran, it's true of India and Pakistan. And so we need to worry a bit about the proposition that the world as a whole is going to stay as calm and stable and open to broad and peaceful commerce as it has been for the last 50 years. I think that's a major risk going forward.
Certainly many Americans have benefited from the growing availability of, you know, relatively inexpensive technologies that replace human labor, the things we might ordinarily do for ourselves. But what happens to the people who are suddenly replaced by machines at work?
That depends very much on the social institutions that we have in place. The technologies obviously have permeated our lives, and they've permeated business environments. I mean, you see this, you go into any drugstore in the last 5 years, and the checkout clerks have largely disappeared. One can go down the list. As a college professor, I, of course, worry about the advent of massively online courses that might make even something as august as my profession technically obsolescent. But people, businesses find that they can modify their business models going forward to make less use of labor, make more use of equipment, which is itself very cheap and is not taxed, doesn't require health insurance, has all kinds of advantages from their point of view. What happens to the people depends upon whether they have incomes and alternative forms of employment. There are many things that need to be done to improve our communities, to care for the elderly, to deal with our environmental problems, combat climate change. One could go down a list of things that would require lots and lots of people to do them. The question is whether we have the institutions that will provide that employment, whether in the public or the nonprofit or the for-profit sector. And then, of course, as the population gets older, there is a need to make sure that people continue to have stability in their lives, that they continue to have access to health care and access to care that people need as they do get older, so that they can live well. And that itself will absorb other forms of labor. People will be hired to take care of the older population, but only if that population is not left destitute. So adjusting our institutions so that we can, in fact, employ people in useful and needed work is the challenge before us as the technologies come in and basically change the incentives facing private businesses.
There's so much debate over what would happen to the economy if we passed a significant increase in the minimum wage. Will this empower the working classes? Will it gut businesses? What is your perspective?
Well, there are two things that go on when you pass an increase in the minimum wage, and I've been associated with proposals to raise it to $12. One is that you raise the cost for lots of businesses. There's no question that you do that. But at the same time, first of all, their own balance sheets, the effect is a little better than you might expect because they don't have as much turnover in their workforces. They get a more productive working team, so their costs per unit don't rise by that much. Secondly, the most important effect is that their clientele has much more money coming through the front door. So what businesses, some businesses lose on the cost side, they gain back on the sales side. And the experience of countries with much higher minimum wages or that have introduced minimum wages in recent years, and Great Britain is a very good example of this, is that while people warned that they would lose a lot of jobs, in fact, they didn't. In fact, what happened was that you had a stabilization and improvement in conditions for low-wage working people, but the business sector came along and handled the change just fine. I think that would be the case in the United States. I think it would be very good in the state of Texas, where we have a lot of low-wage workers, and it would affect us much more than it would affect higher cost of living parts of the country. It would also have a very interesting effect on immigration, because employers would have less incentive to seek out vulnerable undocumented populations, and they would have more documented workers showing up to apply for the better paid jobs. So from the standpoint of stabilizing the immigration situation, this would be a very, I think, useful and effective tool. It's very interesting, of course, that it's also very popular. And we saw in the last election, there were quite a number of states that had minimum wage provisions on the ballot. In states which elected Republican senators, those provisions, all of them passed. So I think this is a coming issue, and one which is important politically and could be basically nonpartisan and bipartisan in nature.
What happens to folks who are already making just above the minimum wage when one of these increases comes along? Would the people already making $12 likely be bumped up to $17, or are they in effect, in terms of distinguishing themselves from their lower paid coworkers, are they brought back down?
No, they get a raise. Mm-hmm. They're generally
across the board.
Across the board effect, sure. If you're getting the minimum wage plus two, then, or plus three, when the minimum goes up, you'll get an effect as well. So it's good for a very broad spectrum of lower paid workers. It's not going to affect workers in manufacturing who are typically getting $15, $20 or more from the get-go, but it would have a very important reorganizing effect on work relations in the services sector.
James K. Galbraith is my guest. He is Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. We'll take your calls after the break. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email me, think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with James K. Galbraith, who is Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School at UT. His new book is called The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. One of the underlying themes, according to some economists about the cause of the Great Depression was this accumulation of wealth, and that's just not sustainable. And then I was surprised during the recession about how many corporations, like a low-end services, like McDonald's or Family Dollar stores, how much their bottom line was hurt when people, just working-class people, just couldn't afford to buy stuff. I wonder if you couldn't comment on those two things and if there's some sort of tipping point there.
Well, they're in many ways two sides of the same coin. What tends to happen in the run-up to a crash is you get a big boom in the price of of some particular class of assets, stock prices in 1929, technology stocks in 1999, asset-backed securities, mortgage-backed securities in the run-up to the big debacle in 2007-2008. And that has two effects. It greatly boosts the incomes of the already wealthy, or of a particular class of newly wealthy who happen to be at the top of the right firm at the right time. And that shows up as this increase in the inequality of incomes and wealth. But it also there is a broader effect that supports the living standards of the population. A boom is a boom. Lots of working people get jobs, and they work more hours, and they get overtime, and their consumption standards go up. And so when you hit the crash, which basically is inevitable if that's the source of the boom period, then the wealth goes away. The rich people are paying much less in taxes the following year because they haven't got any capital gains. But the incomes for the working population also go away. Construction workers lose their jobs because there's no more construction. And one can go down the list. In modern times, where households have a lot of fixed consumer durables that they are buying, cars and appliances and houses for that matter, what happens is that they defer those purchases. And so you have a huge fall in the consumption of that kind of item, much less decline in the purchases of daily necessities. So if you can if you have to keep something going, that's what you keep going, and you give up, you make do with older consumer durables.
How did we arrive at a moment where the IT and banking sectors have such a great concentration of wealth and power as compared with industries that focus on making tangible goods?
Well, the IT sector does make tangible goods.
Yeah.
It does a great deal of its production offshore. How did we arrive at this? Beginning in the late 1970s, early 1980s, we moved to a model of growth which was almost exclusively bank and credit financed, bank credit and what came to be known as shadow banking. And that moved in waves, of which information technology, when it came along, was maybe the last great business-oriented wave of credit spending. So we moved in that direction by, first of all, depleting the other sources of growth that had supported the economy in a much more balanced way in that first 20 or 30 years after World War II. And in particular, in the early 1980s, we crushed the manufacturing sector. The enormous increase in the value of the dollar and the surge of imports from Korea and Japan, to some extent Germany, and then a little later on, this vast wave coming out of China, meant that part of the American economy, which had been a third of all employees in the 1950s, has shrunk to something less than 10%, about 8% now. And basically, in much of the country, is insignificant.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jennifer in Tyler. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
I'm retired now, but I spent a good deal of my career in compensation or wage and salary analysis in the private sector. And the ripple effect of changing the minimum wage really expands, because you have first-line supervisors that now no longer make, because they're exempt from the overtime provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act, suddenly don't make more than their subordinates who are making, time and a half. But I just wanted to comment that that there is a huge ripple effect that kind of upsets the equilibrium. But secondly, what is your guest's opinion of what's wrong with labor supply and demand determining wage rates?
Thanks for your call.
I agree there is a large ripple effect, and the point you make about these very poorly paid so-called managerial employees and the classification of low-grade employees as managers in order to avoid fair labor standards is an extremely important point. What's wrong with allowing supply and demand to determine the level of wages is that you don't have a balance of power between the employer and the employee. You have, on the one side, a vast corporation, we can call it Walmart or McDonald's, and on the other side, a small group of vulnerable employees who may have very little in the way of basically trying to get by. And that's been known since the time of Adam Smith. That's a fundamental imbalance, and no society really relies on equal bargaining between two entities like that. A second point, though, is that when a large corporation has a very large low-wage labor force, what actually happens is that they then rely on the state to provide benefits to that labor force. So the taxpayer has to shell out for food stamps, for example, or for other forms of public assistance to the workers for a large and highly profitable corporation. And that's fundamentally unfair. Raising the minimum wage then basically says to the corporation, well, you know, the taxpayer, we're going to make your workers paid at a standard so that the taxpayer is not supporting them on the side. It means that you, the corporation, are not getting a huge subsidy from the state, which is currently the case. So that's another reason why people who have conservative beliefs, some of which in this respect I absolutely share, should, I think, converge with labor activists and social activists around the cause of a higher minimum wage. And in fact, my great collaborator on this effort was the former publisher of a magazine called The American Conservative, who came into this cause precisely because he saw exactly the same thing happening.
Other institutions getting an ever smaller percentage of subsidies from the state are universities and even K-12 school systems. What's been the effect of that? And is there a way to sort of right size the kind of government spending we do to invest in the education of the next generation of workers?
Well, I think I'm very much I'm an educator. Okay, I just shouldn't
full disclosure, bias
right here. But I do think that providing decent and effective educational system and a solid path right through university is a very effective way of both preparing the younger population for their future lives, but also of relieving the social stress that comes from an unstable economy. I mean, fundamentally, if everybody could get really good jobs right out of high school, then you could have a much smaller system of community colleges and universities than we need. But that's not the case, and it makes a lot of sense to give people, young people, the alternative of spending time and gaining skills, but also gaining a broader perspective on the world in these institutions. What one observes, I mean, in another prosperous or anyway developed part of the world, namely Europe, where many fewer young people are in universities compared to the United States, is that the social tensions in the young population are much higher than they are here. So I think that this is something where we actually got it right in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and we should be continuing to build upon that success. It also means that we can attract very talented people from all over the world, which gives our economy a leg up going forward.
We have an email here from Julie who wants to know if and or how you think the passage of the Graham-Leach Bliley Act in 1999, Bliley Act, contributed to the new normal of today's economy.
The Graham-Leach Bliley Act was the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was the division between investment banks and commercial banking. And it was that repeal was an important factor in building up some of the most abusive practices that we saw in the 2000s, because it meant that commercial banks could do the whole job of making the loan and then securitizing and selling it, that they previously had to work with counterpart organizations in order to do. So it certainly accelerated the debacle. Equally bad, maybe worse, was a bill that passed in 2000 called the Commodities Future Modernization Act that was put into the law at the last minute of the Clinton administration, I think principally by Senator Graham, that made it impossible to regulate credit default swaps, a particular type of a financial derivative. And that led ultimately and quite directly to the collapse of the insurance company AIG at the peak of the crisis. So the inability to see inside these mega financial institutions and try and regulate and discipline their activity, and the inability to regulate these derivative instruments were both important contributing factors to the debacle.
In this new normal environment, what sort of, at least short-term, future do you see for organized labor and other worker advocacy movements?
Well, I think the role of organized labor may begin to grow from here, in so far as we clearly need an alternative strategy to support the living standards of the middle class. And the Democratic Party, in particular, has become very dependent upon the financial sector and has, I think, its reverses in the last election are due to the fact that it doesn't represent in any clear-cut way for Americans the fortunes and prospects of working people in the middle class. And that, you look at the senators who were defeated and the few who survived, there's a very clear pattern in that respect. Organized labor is in the business these days of trying to articulate a vision that would represent a forward movement for middle class Americans, for working Americans, and I think that's going to be a very important role going forward. If the Democratic Party can be saved, it will be saved in alliance with organized labor and not in opposition to it.
Relative to our late 20th century history, have we lost the ability to control or influence the global economy in quite the way we once did?
Oh, yes, for sure. I think we need to recognize that the reality of essentially unilateral American leadership in the Cold War period has gone, and that the idea that this would be replaced by a single benign ultra superpower presiding over the entire world was always an illusion that we entertained in the 1990s and up until the middle 2000s, but we ought to be thoroughly disabused of it now. And the fact is that we need to work out how to live peacefully with regions which are increasingly taking their own path and independently of us. That's true in Central Asia, it's true in Russia, true of China. It's also true in South America, where for a decade and a half, countries which have become very democratic and very open in their political systems and have gone way past the military regimes of a generation ago, have been defining their own economic ideas and increasingly acting as partners rather than dependencies of the United States. So we need to come to grips with this and get used to it.
Jump in here. The new book by James K. Galbraith is The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. James, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Marshall Noor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.